I'm Stargate Pioneer.
I'm Haley.
And I'm Lauren from Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D.
A podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts
at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
You guys suck.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Flashy lights, Christmas, woo!
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 131 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we travel 3,000 years to the future to find ourselves locked in step with events from 18th century France, faced with wind-up robots hell-bent on harvesting the organs of a pretty girl once she reaches legal age. Wait, are we discussing Doctor Who or Torchwood here? I'm your host, Haley, and with me in the GPR studios this week, we have Jay. How are you today, Jay?
I'm doing outstanding. How are you?
I am okay. And we also have Keir. How are you today, sir?
Better than okay.
Okay.
Well, this week we decide we are going to step one level deeper into our arc of appreciation of our personal favorites. And we're going with Jay's episode selection this week, which is Girl in the Fireplace. This being Stephen Moffat's sophomore outing as a writer for the 2005 Regenerated show. It has also, at times, been argued as the episode that set the stage for the Doctor and Rose's pseudo-romance, or blatant romance, depending on how you want to look at it. To this day, it continually appears on numerous top 10 lists of selected episodes from now, hey, 10 years, woohoo, of New Who production. So in this anniversary week of sorts that we're celebrating, we decide to kneel down respectfully to the king, to the courtesan, to Madame de Pompadour.
Yeah, this episode has always been one of my favorites. Like, from the first time that I watched it, it was one that just really captured me, and that, you know, everything about it just made so much, it was so much fun and so much exciting storytelling and a great level of humor and horror. And it was just so well put together. There were so many aspects of it that I just fell in love with. And I mean, to this day, it still holds up. I was literally watching it right before we started the podcast, and it still holds up as one of my favorite episodes. And I use this. This is the second episode that I usually give people when I'm trying to get them hooked on the show.
That's understandable. I mean, yeah, we've all probably seen this episode countless times, but it's one of those ones that does have that kind of, I'll say it is up there in the Shawshank factor for catching you as you're flipping through the dial. No matter how many times you see it, you can still drop into it at any point and be actively engaged in the story from wherever you are, because it does have this nice blend of suspense, action, humor elements, but it's still very touching. It's a very, very touching story in its own right. And I think it was by design, you know, from its construct and from its early conception. If you do a little history on the production of the episode, when it was shot in 2005 and aired in 2006, it was Moffat's pen, but it was based on a seed of an idea that came into RTD's mind when he was working with David Tennant on the series Casanova. And he was doing a lot of background research on 17th and 18th century France, got really invested in the intricate nature and history of Renette's past as this sort of a what kind of a Renaissance woman before that sort of a concept really made sense. So it just became something that would make an interesting supporting character and now almost kind of pseudo companion.
Yeah. And I mean, this one has been, you know, praised. It won the Hugo Award in 2007. You know, it's got all kinds of accolades behind it because it's one of those episodes that everybody knows. You know, like we said at the top of the show, it's, you look at all the top 10 lists or stuff. And I mean, especially this week, you know, you kept seeing those lists of, these are the episodes from the past 10 years of Doctor Who you have to watch. And this one was in, you know, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, maybe not all of them. I didn't get to read all of them because there were literally thousands. Dear God.
You made people. A list of lists. Yeah. And just bear in mind here that just in terms of the strength, at this point in the earlier inceptions of the show's reintroduction to the public eye, you had a very tight core team behind RTD. And Eurus Lynn at the directing helm, whom at this point had already done a couple of episodes in the Eccleston season, and then came on here to take a couple of episodes within this, now if you want to consider this series too, depending on how you're counting, but went on to stay intrinsically involved in the Who universe, including all of season 3 of Torchwood, and Forest of the Dead, End of Time, Unquiet Dead, and surprisingly enough, within the same season, Fear Her. Yeah. So you can't bat 1,000. Let's just say. But it wasn't Eurus's writing. So
yeah. Yeah, you can only do so much with that. It's
But one of the things I think, and this is where I figured it might be a decent point to start here, is that because this is a distinct while slightly disjointed, it's technically a period piece.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, he's wearing the brown suit.
Valid point. It would have been great had he like changed suits between, like, as he went through the mirrors. The suit
slaps a different jacket on. But okay, but it's a period piece insofar as Moffat chooses to write, because he never wants to stay still. If there's going to be some wibbly wobbliness, even from these early seasons, it's probably in a good 2/3 of the cases, it's probably going to be because of Moffat's writing, because he loves to toy with the idea. But I think he's got a very, very interesting concept here. Even when we don't even have all the pieces yet, you know, you're only 15, 20 minutes into the episode, and you've already got some things that are really interesting for a sci-fi fan, regardless of whether it's Doctor Who or otherwise, to chew on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even in the first couple moments, you know, you get on there and it's, you know, okay, you've got this spaceship that's completely powered up. The engines are just completely full blown going and nobody's around. It's a derelict ship that is, you know, pedal to the metal, but isn't going anywhere. So you've already got that mystery being laid down there. And, you know, then you start to introduce the period piece, you know, underneath that and start to tie it in. It worked really, really well because it, you know, when, if you're not into the period stuff, they do enough on the ship and they do enough of the, you know, explaining how things are working to keep you engaged in that aspect. But if you're not into the whole techno babble complete, you know, I didn't want to say magic door thing. Yeah. It works really well because you've got all this stuff in France, which is one, it's a period piece, but two, it's also a character piece.
Right.
Yeah, this is something that is very heavily character driven. So it works on so many different levels.
Mm-hmm. I sort of saw this as a character journey, but it was to a certain extent, it was a journey for all of our principal characters involved to a certain, you know, to whatever degree. You know, Rose's character progresses a certain amount. Mickey certainly does, because this is his premier voyage in the TARDIS. He now officially can wear the badge that he's earned his flown in time badge. You know, the Renette definitely, obviously you see her go through her entire life's journey, but the Doctor himself also progresses and develops within the story, albeit rather emotionally and kind of sadly, but nonetheless.
But see, that's one of the reasons why I feel this works so well for my introductory set, that, you know, because the first one I always show people is the 11th Hour, because that's, you know, new companion, new doctor, you get all of the pieces you need to really understand how the show functions and what the show's about and that kind of thing. And it works really well for, you know, summing everything up into a 60-minute block. This one goes a step further to really get you in touch with who the doctor is and let you understand the character of the doctor. So it works so well to, you know, say, okay, here's this person, here's the story behind him and everything like that. Okay, let's get to know him a little bit better and see, you know, let you fall in love with him. Then I usually follow up with Dalek, which makes you say, oh, okay, yes, this person that I love, wow, he's got a dark side now.
Yeah. No, I can see that. If 11th Hour is something that endears you to him because he's charming and affable, but also has that analytical mind, you know, as he's taking apart the whole Prisoner Zero, you know, challenge, this is one that shows that he's, I'm not going to say fallible, but he has corners of his, you know, and recesses within his persona that are bruised. You know, he's damaged goods, but it's damaged in a way that makes characters interesting. You want to see how they're dealing with whatever this, in this particular case, this implication of loneliness that if you've got a little bit of an understanding from using 11th Hour to know how old he actually is and that he's borne all of these faces and that he's been all of these things for all of these years. Mm-hmm. Well, that tells you in your mind, God, you've seen everything come and go. You know, we've played around with that whole idea of who wants to live forever and watch everybody die. That's got a weigh on you, doesn't it? Sure. Here's an episode that shows that you're carrying some baggage as a result.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
And then Dalek is the side of that where, oh yeah. And by the way, some of the things that you come across, you know, in your journeys are going to leave you, not only bruised, but slightly scarred and angry.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but one of the things I think as far as the tone of the story that I particularly like, and it really runs through all the aspects of the production itself, is that it has this kind of inquisitive, coy, having fun even with the threatening situations that really engages the viewer. So that even when things are at their most alarming, there are aspects to it that make you want to see how the individual characters are going to react and where, you know, where the turns are going to happen.
Yeah.
Often because of humor, because this is Tennant just really firing on all pistons. This is such a great, you know, prototypical.
I was gonna say this is pretty much the, you know, the quintessential 10th Doctor kind of action. You know, it's the, when you think Tennant, this is the kind of doctor you think. You know, either this or the dark brooding staring at the camera and, you know, furious with everything, but
emotional hair.
Yeah, exactly. Hair quivers emotionally.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you've got everything from the running about, because this all begins as a chance to show Mickey, you know, an opportunity to be able to kind of impress him. This is the setting out once again to be the, you know, so where do you want to go today?
Yeah.
Kind of a adventure. And those always turn out real well.
Exactly. You'd think he'd learn something, but no. And I mean, this episode had a great mechanic of, you know, it's something that you see in Joss Whedon stuff where, you know, if the audience is laughing, you scare them. If they're scared, you make them laugh. Mm-hmm. And you think about it. I mean, there's so many times in this where things start to get really tense, like, you know, Mickey and Rose strapped to the beds about to get chopped up. And then the doctor comes in, you know, quote unquote, drunk. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, those great moments where everything gets really, really tense. And then something happens to make you laugh and it really alleviates the tension. And then there's times where everything seems to be going good and you're laughing. And then the clockwork droids pop up and it's like, okay, back into action and everything's going. And
right. Yeah. So, I mean, as far as some of the things that, you know, we mentioned that the characters and their little paths along the way just within this episode, we mentioned in the introduction that this has been credited by some, and I'm not going to say universally, but by some as the door opener to the 10th Rose relationship or pseudo relationship, or was it really a relationship, or however you want to treat it. Where do each of you stand on the validity of that claim?
I think it's a valid claim because up to this point we hadn't seen a romantic side of the doctor. He'd been, you know, pretty straight-laced and hey, let's go on an adventure guy before this episode.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's how I feel too. It's pretty much, you know, up to this point, we hadn't had any indication. Like, there was little hints and stuff like that, but I think the most that we had seen is in, was it Parting of the Ways, where the Doctor kisses Rose to get the time vortex out of her, and it just, you know, the plot device thing. And,
right.
And it, you know, that was the most that we'd seen aside from, you know, the Eighth Doctor kissing Grace.
Well, didn't Captain Jack kiss the Ninth Doctor too?
Yeah, but that was all Jack. That wasn't the Doctor. But
because then if the Doctor just moved slightly to his left, Jack would have just made out with the lamppost or the mailbox nearby or whatever.
Exactly. But yeah.
But I don't know. I personally, I'm not really sure if this is something that, yes, it does. It definitely does show that the Doctor has a romantic heart when, you know, when that chooses to be shown. I don't know if any of this really starts to tip at all towards Rose or vice versa. You know, Rose doesn't even have a whole lot of moments where she does that kind of that wistful look just yet. So I think I see it more clearly in episodes to follow. This one, though, really, I think, allows itself to shine directly on Renette.
Oh, yeah. No, and when I say that I feel like this one is the predecessor for the Doctor and Rose's relationship, it's because it proves that the Doctor can have romantic feelings.
Okay.
Because we understand that Rose can. Like, I mean, she's a girl. She's dating Mickey. She has those kind of connections. But we've never seen anything that indicates that the Doctor can. This indicates that the Doctor can. And then they build on the relationship between him and Rose later.
Okay. All right. Now, as far as the, you know, backing up with the Doctor's signs of affection, or at least adoration and respect for Pompadour, I'm always continually struck by how quickly, when the Doctor believes himself to be separated from the original vessel, you know, the time windows are shattered, he's on the other side, no looking back, because he can't trust those two mopes back in, you know, near the TARDIS to be able to find him at any point. So he's just committed to being trapped there in, you know, as she describes it, the slow path. Mm-hmm. And he's seems absolutely fine with it.
I think that was something that he weighed before he jumped through the window. Because, I mean, let's face it, the Doctor is brilliant. He can do that kind of thing in his sleep. You know, we've seen him do it in his sleep. But, you know, I feel like that was, he made the decision. He was like, okay, here's the pros, here's the cons. I have to do this. And once he jumped on the horse and started to go through the window, the decision was made and he was set and he understood the ramifications of it. So I don't know if it, you know, if he had the struggle and we just weren't privy to it, but I think at that point he had made the decision and he knew the weight that came with it. So, you know, he was good.
Well, and he, you know, he liked her. He was like, oh, I'll hang out with her for a few decades and then, you know, maybe I'll figure out a way home after that because I'm a genius.
Yeah.
Connecticut and King Arthur's court kind of thing. He'll just be the wizard and figure it out. Okay. Well, here's an interesting, another aspect that you can definitely tell that this is a Moffat episode, because he's given us a villain, or at least in this case, a threat. I don't know if you really want to call them villains. They don't really have an evil intent. They're just following programming.
Yeah, they're the antagonists.
Yeah. So, but it is nonetheless in their limited dialogue, in their limited exchange. There's no big theoretical verbal showdown at any point. And yet they're creepy as hell in just going about their business, because, you know, as we all note, you know, that slow revelation about the parts required.
Oh, and I mean, that, I think that one of the brilliant things that Moffat does with his villains is the slow revelation of things, and the, you know, you don't give them too much, because you look at when it's first introduced, you know, the Doctor's in Renette's bedroom and he's just talking to her, and then he goes over to the fireplace and there's that nice pause where he looks at the clock and he's like, okay, that's scary. And at that point, like, the tension just ratchets up to 11, and they drag it out too. It's not a quick, oh crap, what's going on here? You know, he takes his time and it's tense. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he does the screwdriver under the bed and you see the droid like reach out and smack it away real quick, get that jump scare going. And then they slow it down again while he, you know, creeps up back up over the bed and, you know, finally realizes what it is he's faced with.
I got to imagine that to a certain degree, that's because of Moffat's long standing with the show. You know, and you think back to when it was done in the multi-episodic stories, there were a lot of times when you would not get the full revelation of who the baddie was behind the story as a whole until often possibly into the second or third episode of the chunk.
Yeah.
You know, things would be going wrong and there's deaths or harm and people dealing with repercussions, but you don't really know what's at the heart of it until that big reveal. Sometimes more successful than others, but I think that sort of instilled itself into the way that he does his writing and a lot of the way that Who in general or New Who has done, because they all sort of take a page from that book at this point, where you don't just smack somebody over the head right at the outset and say, so, Centaurans are attacking, and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't take that approach. It still stays more of a thriller, and it is more thrilling when you don't immediately know what you're up against.
Yeah. You know, and like you said, the slow reveal of the parts, you know, it's, you hear the line repeated a couple times. It's like, we didn't have the parts. We didn't have the parts. And the doctor's like, yeah, you said that before. You didn't have the, oh.
Ooh.
Oh. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those great moments where it's played out at just the correct speed that the audience is picking up on it at the same point the doctor is. Yeah, and that's one thing I love when the episodes do that correctly. You know, you might be half a second before the doctor, you know, but most of the time, if you're right there with him, it's so rewarding. Because I know there's episodes that I've sat down and watched, and, you know, within the first 3 or 4 minutes, I'm like, okay, this happened, then this happened, and there's this, and okay, this is going to be fun to watch how it plays out, but I've already got it figured out in my head. But when they do it that way, where it's, you know, the slow reveal kind of thing, like, and I think part of that is because they didn't spend a lot of time on it. It was like, okay, they said that there was roast at the beginning. You know, it's like, oh, okay, that's weird. And then you see the eye and then you see the heart and you're like, what the heck? But they move past it quick enough that it's not something you're trying to figure out. Right. It gives you the clues that you need in order to understand it later, but they don't dwell on it long enough for you to actually put brain power into it.
Mm. So what are some of the, some of the aspects of the story progression itself that particularly resonate with you? I mean, we talk about the balance between, you know, comedy and action and that sort of thing, the highs and the lows. But are there aspects of the character interplay or just of the writing itself that really resonate strongly with you that keep this what is a good episode and puts it in the great episode box?
Yeah.
Well, the tragic ending always makes it last, you know?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, because that's something that sticks with you.
Right.
Yeah.
And as is typical with some of those ones we've gotten with these sad endings, it's not just a single gut punch.
Yeah, no.
It's a couple of blows to the kidneys, you know? You get to see the carriage hearse, you know, drifting off, but then there's also the fact that we get the final reveal as the ship turns around into the sunlight, and you finally, in the last seconds, get to understand why it is that these single-minded droids had decided to go after her for 37 years.
Well, I think this was actually our first introduction to the, you know, teary doctor face from Tenet.
Oh, yes. Yes, sad puppy face. Yes.
Yeah, because, I mean, let's face it. I mean, that face haunts your dreams, and it's something you see, and it's, you know, instantly brings you to
tears.
Just
when he makes the face, you see the gif of him standing in the rain.
Exactly, yes. But, yeah, I mean, let's face it, that face that he makes, it conveys so much emotion, and that's why it's so powerful, is because it's one of those that just sticks with you regardless.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, this is the first time that we really had to come face to face with that after so many gut punches that you got, you know?
Right. So. I think with regards to, I think one of the reasons why the episode itself is so popular is because Raynette's character remains so well loved, and not just because she happened to marry the doctor. Isn't this great? happens to be the daughter of the doctor.
No, that's different.
I'm thinking of the doctor's own.
No, but he was dating Sophia Miles at the time that this episode filmed. Right.
Yes, nepotism. Yay.
It works for everybody. But the whole idea that relationship cut short, or I should say necessarily relationship, but just their time together cut short. Yet she was built up historically and within the script to be such a capable character. Mm-hmm. You know, she's fearless. You know, she jumps through, you know, the changing doorway to enter into the ship. You know, she's willing to face off against the clockwork droids. Once she realizes that they're not going to overtly harm her, she decides she's going to try to take matters into her own hands. She would have made a compelling even for a short term, a compelling companion to travel with. Or even if they didn't travel, just to have more time with her because she understood the Doctor better than he was prepared to have someone, you know, when the mind meld reverses.
Yeah.
You know,
she reversed the polarity.
Exactly. But because we're denied that, you know, that absence making the heart grow fonder, I think that combining that with a tragic ending here is one of the things just, oh, if we could have just had 15 minutes more or one episode more is one of those things why, you know, we'd love to go back. But I guess I'll throw this out to the two of you. Is this one of those instances where if you wanted to do a little bit of time bending and allow her to have one more voyage, would it undermine everything that we currently appreciate?
I think so.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it, as fun as she was and as painful as it was at the end when when everything kind of fell apart, it added to the episode so much that if it had been one of those happy things where she goes back through the door and you see the TARDIS dematerialize and then, you know, we get a few minutes with her in the next episode, this would have been a fun episode, but it wouldn't be one that people remember so fondly.
What? You're saying that the death of characters actually has merit in certain instances?
What?
What? It would be like bringing Donna back after the ending she had. Like, yes, we'd love to see the character again, but it would cheapen the weight of the ending.
Yeah. You know, almost like having Rose standing on a beach, just completely destroyed, and then giving her the Doctor later.
Well, yep.
So you can send that hate mail to jay@gallifreypublicradio.com.
But whatever horrible statements you're going to write to him, leave the last couple words off.
Yeah. You know, that's one thing you brought it up, the reversing the mind reading thing. And that's one thing that I loved about this character that was crafted was because it kind of showed that she was intelligent. She was very intelligent and capable. And, you know, she recognized, one, she instantly recognized what the Doctor was doing and then was able to reverse it when he was unaware that could have been done or, you know, not prepared for it or whatever the case is. You know, it added a lot to her to say that she's, you know, not only capable in, you know, the stuff that she knows, but throw her into an alien situation and she's on top of it. You know, when Rose comes to warn her about the thing, she's like, I don't have time to explain it to you. And, you know, her line of then be thorough and I will be attentive, and then able to, you know, basically sum it up much better than Rose had been able to do, you know, just based off of a few lines.
There's a vessel. It's a sky
a ship.
Ship.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's one reason why this character was so great was because it felt like Moffat took the time to really show how capable and intelligent she really was.
Mm-hmm. I gotta say though, I don't want to take anything away from Rose in this one though, either. Mm-hmm. Even though she obviously kind of took second fiddle in this particular story, but you can tell at this point, you know, she's now a couple of episodes in to traveling with Tenth, but she is well prepped.
Right.
You know, she's definitely in her element at this point, especially because she gets to a certain degree wear the shiny prefect badge because she's showing Mickey the ropes. Which emboldens her, you know, to a great degree in a, you know, being the first one to reach for, you know, the ice gun or whatever, you know, the case may be.
Yeah,
you know, so it's a strong episode for Rose Tyler as well, I think.
Yeah, I think so, and it's because at this point you get to see her going off and doing her own thing with her companion. You know, that's that's one thing that's always fun is when the companion reaches that point that they get to go off and be the, you know, Dr. Light version with their own companion. It's always fun because at that point you see how much they have learned from the Doctor, but also it shows how much they still need him. And I think it adds to both the characters by doing that.
And in his own right, I'd say as far as Mickey's first experience being exposed to some of these things, overtly exposed to some of these things, or where he's aware that he's in it, rather than it just happening and him running around trying to make sense of things on Earth, he handles it relatively well, you know, better than some, you know, the whole, you know, but they're speaking English.
Yeah.
She gives him the quick explanation. He looks at it. He kind of dog heads for a second, lets it sink in. Okay, go move on to the next thing.
Yeah, he's definitely not, you know, Ricky from the end of the series, but he's getting there, and it wasn't too bad. The only part that really gets me is at the end when the Doctor is trapped in France and Rose is sitting there staring at what used to be the time window, and he continually, like, over and over again, okay, but how's he getting back? We're stuck here. What are we going to do? How's he going to get back? And, you know, Rose is just dealing with the fact that they're stuck there. How are they going to get back? And he just keeps on saying it like, you know, Rose is going to be like, oh, no, there's this. And it just, it irritates me. I understand it, and it fits the character, and it works, you know, it works for him, but it just irritates the crap out of me every time.
Well, he's kind of an annoying character, so that his characteristics annoy you fits.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what he's saying.
Haley, you've been awfully quiet. What do you think
of
this
different.
Episode? Yeah. What do you think of this episode?
I really like it. And this is the first time I've watched it in a while. But this time through, I noticed elements that are picked up in other episodes and used. Like, you know, we've got some from the most recent series. You've got the monster under the bed that's kind of similar to Listen. The robots look a lot like the ones we saw in Deep Breath, the clockwork robots. And I feel part of the story, the whole Madame de Pompadour, the Doctor kind of jumping through her life, is kind of similar to what we saw in 11th Hour with how he met Amy. You know, he meets her first as a child and then jumps ahead 12 years.
Mm-hmm. I thought you said 6 months.
I was only gone for, what was it, 5.5 hours?
Yeah.
Well, I think take that. That's probably, again, because this is Moffat's hand here. I have to believe that when he hits things that along the course of his writing that really work well, you know, the gold star credits that he gives himself for certain things, he files those away as tools and strategies or thematic elements that he can utilize in a different light, you know, not always just, you know, carbon copies or anything, although the clockwork droids were pretty darn close. To the point where when we started seeing them in Deep Breath, a lot of people, as they were starting to review it, thought that this was the natural progression of them.
Yeah.
That by the time the whole idea of parts for the ship ran out, then they started breaking down, so they needed parts for themselves to the point where they start reaching sentience. So I don't know if that's necessarily even to this day been completely put to bed, but I get that.
Yeah, but I mean, that was something that was hinted at in the episode, was, you know, the Doctor talking about it. He's like, there's something very familiar about this. And it was one of those throwaway lines to nod to where it came from. But I don't know if that was something he meant to flesh out or still intends to, or if it was just like, okay, yes, it's similar, let's move on.
Yeah. Well, Haley mentioned the monsters under the bed line. I mean, the way it was actually phrased, too, still catches my ears, because he said, even monsters under the bed have nightmares. So, I mean, it was all that was just kind of the, you know, or the everybody has nightmares thing. And it's just such a setup for, well, everyone?
Yeah.
Sure. Or even the Doctor. We'll talk about that later. Put that one on the hook. We'll stick a pin in that one and get back to it in 5 years.
Right. Yeah. Well, the monsters came up a lot in this episode. You know, dealing with monsters is the price you pay for getting to be around the Doctor.
Yeah, or the, you know, the line she has about, you know, one may tolerate the demons for the sake of an angel. And that was, yeah, that was a recurring theme, was the, you know, the monsters and the demons that we deal with on a daily basis. Or, you know, the things in our lives that we deal with. So, yeah, it was definitely a recurring theme in the episode.
But I also, I personally really appreciate the we're talking about the, you know, 10th being totally, you know, full-on 10th in this, you know. But his fascination with everything that's going on, you know, as he's seeing, he was just genuinely impressed with the droids. He was impressed with, you know, the use of the time windows, even though he couldn't figure it out yet. Just what was going on in this strange connection between 3000 and 1800, you know, was just fascinating. And it was this great challenge. And these are some of the episodes that, some of the Doctor episodes where he gets put up against something that he hasn't yet fully understood, as opposed to the ones where he's showing somebody, let me take you to a society where I know everything all about it already.
Yeah.
And something bad happens. This is a mystery that he wants solved. Those are always so much more engaging, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's true.
Right, and I missed Tennant, but I didn't realize how much I just missed his line delivery until this episode, with all the wells and ohs and just the way he trails off into his thoughts. I miss it.
I still love the beginning of the episode when they come off the TARDIS and it's like, no, it's completely safe. Well. Not too dangerous. You know what, just in case, let's go ahead and take this. Scan, just in case there's something dangerous. And it, I mean, it is just a great way of showing his, you know, how he gets overcome with his excitement at times. And it's like, I want to get out and I want to do the thing and I want to, you know, and then he kind of catches himself and says, okay, wait, there are precautions to be taken here. And it, I mean, that is characteristic of his doctor too. And, you know, how many times does he just automatically rush off and do a thing and then think, oh, I should have done this after. But
we'll clean it up in post.
Exactly. But I mean, there were some fantastic lines in this episode, though. I mean, like we said before, you know, the humor was definitely there in force. The whole thing with the horse is just absolutely brilliant. I mean, yes, it was just a gag and it was just there for comedic effect, you know, but it was done so well that it's a fun thing to see in the episode. You know? And then the line of, you know, it's like when he names it Arthur and,
you're not keeping the horse.
Well, I let you keep Mickey, you know. I
and
love
Mickey was very much the puppy dog in this episode.
True, true. Yeah. But we get so much out of the script for this episode that it become, you know, signature lines for Who in general. Just, you know, I'll call them con badge quotes.
Well, yeah, I was actually going to say, because at Gallifrey 1, we met a cosplayer who was Madame de Pompadour, and the ribbon that she was given out said the, you know, thick, thickity, thick face from Thickhound, Thickania, and so's your dad.
Yep. This is where we get our always bring a banana to a party.
Yeah.
You know, it's an opportunity, the goofiness, when he's really playing around with it, you know, and Moffat really being able to stretch his comedic writing, because this is right around the time, obviously, when Coupling was airing as well. So he was just really in that mode. It goes along with the timing. And when you've got a cast, an actor talent that can do that kind of delivery and really have fun with it while there are sparks flying and, you know, mirrors crashing, not all that well. The mirror. CGI probably could have been given a couple extra bucks that week, but
I don't think the CGI department had $2.
Yeah, it's a valid point. Yeah, but I mean, when you go into some of the behind the scenes stuff, like they actually wanted to, yeah, to show the doctor riding the horse around in the ballroom at Versailles, and they couldn't get the permission to do it because
wonder why.
I remember seeing something behind the scenes saying they were interviewing they were showing them talking to the guy, and he was like, no, I just, you know, we're worried about them damaging the floor and things like that. And it's just, so you kind of like, well, they did the best they could. Instead, they had Tennant sitting on like a PVC thing that held him up high above everybody else, and they just kind of rolled him around on casters. And it was, so it's like, yeah, they did the best with what they had, but yeah, you could have given them a little bit more.
But nonetheless, I mean, it's quickly forgiven, I would say. Or at least it gets quickly forgotten.
Well, because I mean, once you've seen it once, you understand as you're sitting down to watch it again for the subsequent times, you know, it gets to that point when you hear the horse neigh, you're like, oh, hey, look, I'm out of chips. Time to go to the kitchen.
Well, and at this point in Doctor Who, I think your expectations for special effects were set at an appropriate level to make it okay.
Yes, let's face it. It's not a magma monster.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, the masks on the droids themselves were very intricate pieces that were custom done for BBC One for those episodes. And obviously, you know, once the mask reveal and the wig is pulled off, the intricacy of the gear work within the droid heads, that's gorgeous. I mean, it's just amazing stuff. And, you know, to the point where they ended up doing it again in Deep Breath, probably the same props. Who knows? But yeah, yeah. It's just that. So many things that are so memorable from this one, or ones that you keep catching yourself picking up on later on.
Yeah, it's, and I mean, I don't see this one being knocked out of my top spot anytime soon.
Mm. Is this the first time we get the Doctor Who line?
No.
Okay.
I remember Jackie did it in the Christmas special when, you know, when the Doctor comes out of the TARDIS and passes out. Mm-hmm. You know, and Rose is like, it's the Doctor, and then, you know, Jackie gets to give the line, but this one was definitely less jarring. It made sense, and it was one of those, like, it took you a second to be like, oh, wait, she just did the thing. And
Yeah. The best deliveries of those are ones where you think, oh, I might get an answer. And she was so sincere, you know, with her line of questioning and her adoration and concern for him. You thought he might say, well,
yeah,
funny you should ask.
So, I don't know. This is one of those that I just, like you said, you know, it comes on. I will always sit down and watch it. And then there are times where I'm like, you know, I want to sit down and I want to watch something. This is usually one of the first ones that comes to mind for me to sit down and watch. So I'm firmly, you know, I stand firmly behind putting this as my favorite episode for this arc. All right. So the first news article we've got, there was a lot of this stuff that came out when, yeah, when the 50 or the 10th year anniversary came, 50, then 2 years, then 10. Yeah. It's, there was an interview with Russell T. Davies and, you know, 10 years after the fact that they asked him, you know, what would you have changed about Rose? And, you know, he brought up some of the things that we've been kind enough to kind of gloss over the past couple of years. And, but you know, and it's just a couple things in there that, you know, didn't really detract from the story. They weren't anything horrible, but it was just, you know, things that he didn't care for, like the, you know, the little improv dance that Mickey did, and the see-through money bag, because really,
it's, well, if you don't have time to explain, this bag is full of cash.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right, you expect them to go to the bank and get a money bag, please?
With a that's dollar not sign in the budget on the side.
Exactly. Doesn't even have a zipper. It's just one of those sacks.
But no, I mean, I just like the fact that these sort of, I always love, you know, just like we all like listening to commentary tracks on episodes or films, things like that. This is an opportunity for people in retrospect to go back and talk about, you know, the positives and the negatives. But the negatives are always really interesting because it's like, you know, the emperor has no clothes kind of thing. So you can't actually bad talk your own material. You're supposed to, you know, you're supposed to be the consummate showman and sell the stuff up all the time. And RTD's like, nah. No, you know what? Rose's room was disgustingly pink, we needed to tone that down because it was actually
hurting
our
enemies. And looking at it now, it's like four shades of terrible pink.
Yeah,
it's.
I mean, let's face it. You could chew bubble gum and throw it in there to tone it down. It's. Yeah. But you know, and then there's the fact that they were in Trafalgar Square and you only see Nelson's column in the establishing shot. Because honestly, I never knew that they were in Trafalgar Square. Like, I did not know that's where they were.
One of the most iconic locations in all of Northern Europe, and you don't shoot it.
Yeah. And he goes on to say, he's like, yeah, if we were doing it now, I would just walk up and physically turn the camera around. But this was early on, and he was trying to be nice. You know, and then he talks about the, you know, when the doctor falls over and breaks Jackie's coffee table. And then it's never brought up again. And he's like, do you really think that Jackie's the kind of person that would let that go and never
of all people?
Like, no, you need that referred to like at least 3 times per episode.
She's never going to say it. That's the only reason she doesn't like the doctor.
That's why she had a rough time with him.
That would have been the best running gag. You going to IKEA this weekend? Buy me a new coffee table.
Oh, but yeah, I mean, just little things that kind of bothered him. And it's very interesting to see that, you know, it's, you know, the things that made us think that the production quality wasn't exactly the highest are things that bother him to this day and things that he wouldn't mind changing. But then at the very end, you know, he says that the things that he would change about the episode were absolutely nothing. Mm.
For all of, you know, you can nitpick some of the technical aspects, but the episode did exactly what it wanted to do.
Yeah. It brought the show back and it, you know, look at how huge it is now. So, you know, clearly it did something right.
Yep.
Oh, and then the next bit of news that we've got is actually, so we've talked about the video producer, the John Smith VFX on YouTube, and he's the one that did the Hulock animation thing. He did the video Stone with the Weeping Angels and gave us what we thought was our first look at the
new intro sequence.
No,
Or the dematerialization.
Yeah, the dematerialization that came out a couple weeks ago, and the, you know, the thing with Capaldi on the rain planet that we thought was our first look at him. But yeah, so this time he went a little bit less flashy and awesome, but far more emotional with his tribute to the 10 years of New Who.
Right. Using a long list of carefully selected quotes chronologically through the 10 years of New Who here, and his sort of Ken Burns-ish sort of walkthrough recreations of the scenes that they were attributed to, you basically get a walk through some of the iconic moments all the way from Rose to present. And of course, it's done in sepia tones, so you know it's going to be feely.
Sepia means emotion.
Yes.
There is a scene with like 100 floating adipose, so don't worry, that's in there.
Yeah, along with the Donna quote of, "You're not mating with me, sunshine." So. But the next bit of news we've got is actually about Big Finish, who renewed their license for Doctor Who for another 5 years.
Yes. Because it was getting dodgy there for a little bit.
We didn't know. I mean, the relationship between them is kind of, eh.
The stuff they've been putting out is really questionable. So
yeah, so Big Finish will continue to do Doctor Who stories through the next 5 years, but there's nothing saying anything about new Doctors. They are working in some more current stuff with Kate Stewart, doing stuff with modern day unit. So that's a step towards it, but there's nothing saying whether or not it's actually, if they're actually working towards, new Doctors.
Mm. Yeah. At this point, some of their biggest announcements have been obviously the fact that we're going to be, seeing the new unit series coming out, shortly. And then they had, well, I guess we can kind of tie it right into the other major announcement they put out this week, which was that apparently, Mr. McGann has been back in the recording booth and laying down some new material for another Eighth Doctor adventure. This, I guess, is going to be where we are progressing now after the close of the Dark Eyes series.
Yeah.
And getting a chance to travel with Livchenka, which we were very pleased to hear that she had agreed to travel for a bit.
Yeah, so this is exciting. You're getting the first chunk of it written by Matt Fitton, who obviously took on the latter half of the Dark Eyes saga.
Mm-hmm.
So, very exciting stuff. And
just to mention, this is being referred to as Doom Coalition.
Yeah.
This will be the name of the new series to follow. And it will be done similarly to Dark Eyes. You'll have subsequent series. We'll get this probably, they're saying October, maybe November. I heard another article that said, even Big Finish is saying out in October of this year. A couple of articles that said something about November. I don't know if they're already anticipating a delay in release or what their premise was for saying so. But then in 2016, they've already slated they're going to be doing a minimum of 4 series of this. So we'll go into May of 2016 for the second installment, the fall of 2016 for the third, and then May of 2017 for the fourth and potentially final chapter of this particular series. But anytime you want to give me more Eighth Doctor and Livchenka, just I'm pre-ordering already, which you can do.
Yeah,
head absolutely over to bigfinish.com and plunk down your $20 web special pricing for your pre-order.
So yeah. Is that about the pace they've always done, is 2 series per year?
For what they consider their main track.
Okay.
When you bear in mind the fact that they are releasing 20 to 30 subsequent titles all told, between what they do for Avengers or what they do for the Gallifrey or the Companion Chronicles or anything that is considered secondary or tertiary tracks, you'll see these cornerstone series run on about a 6-month cycle.
Okay.
But they are, I mean, they've got 2 to 3 releases a month minimum. Yeah. Across all the titles represented, and then they have multiple podcasts as well that they do to keep you posted on their progress, or just to be complete goofs for about 30 to 45 minutes.
Yeah,
we would know nothing about that kind of behavior.
Nope.
No, absolutely no horseplay with wet swim trunks and things like that going on.
Or smacking.
They're professionals.
Yeah. Still waiting for the next game show.
Yeah, so that's. I mean, that's exciting. I can't wait to get some more Big Finish stuff going. So,
mm-hmm. And we'll definitely we'll do more as some of this material gets released. I'd like to at some point be able to start to talk about some of these ancillary series that don't often get, because they're sort of off of the main Who track, but they definitely do warrant some discussion and some additional exposure. So hopefully we'll get some chances to talk about them. If we don't do podcasts about them, we'll start doing some posts and some review articles on the GallifreyPublicRadio.com in the weeks and months ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, that's about it for the news that we've got. Next week, Haley's going to be taking over with her favorite episode.
This was a tough decision to make. Like, I've been stressing about it all week. But I finally decided, you know, my go-to, if I'm just going to throw on Doctor Who for a while, it's going to be Silence in the Library and Forest of the Dead. Because I love River Song. So.
Solid choices, yeah.
We will see her introduced and then, spoilers, killed next week.
All within a two-hour span. It's brilliant.
Here's your hat. What's your hurry?
You know, I do find that interesting, though, that both selections from New Who have been Moffat episodes. I think right. That's a little telling.
Moffat writing for Tennant.
Yeah, it's true.
Mm. Well, so this gives you plenty of opportunity to be able to chime in on this here, either in appreciation, in critique, or just in, you know what, I really don't want anyone to touch the light switch in the room for the next couple of weeks, or whatever you need to, however you need to chime in on this. But we definitely want to get your feedback on your thoughts on River, on your thoughts on Moffat writing for Tennant, your thoughts on whether these qualify as your go-to episodes, or whether you stray completely off book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We want to know what everybody else's favorites are too. I mean, as we wrap up this arc, I would love to hear from all of you, you know, what is your favorite episode? If you had to, you know, gun to your head, pick one, which one would you go with? Because I mean, like Haley said, you know, this is something I struggled with too. And I mean, these guys can tell you, as soon as we finished the call last week, as soon as we stopped recording, I was like, oh, why didn't I pick the doctor's wife instead? And, you know, and it's one of those, like, you always have that other episode that could edge out your favorite. And
yeah, that one was on the short list.
Mm-hmm. So let us know. I'd love to get a list of the listeners' favorites as well.
Yeah, we could do that. What, us create a list? We're not pandering to that stuff.
All right. Well, this has been episode 131 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I let you keep Mickey.
And this is Kier saying, yeah, well, I'm the Lord of Time, and I'm here to fix the clock.
And this is Haley saying, a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. Oh, whoops.
Sorry, Isaac.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Allons-y.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2015.